Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Colombo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Colombo's home on the Colombo Chronicles Live to your home, Colombo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose Colombo right here for you, and it's Wednesday. And today is, oh my goodness, it's January 19th. The month is almost over. It's just crazy how fast the time flies. But today on the West Coast, we have a beautiful day. There's birds out, and they're chirping, and the sun, and the sky is blue, and the clouds are white and fluffy. So that's a good sign, and that's a good way to start off today. I hope you are enjoying your day wherever you are around the world. And hey, listen, this is the new year, so if you didn't hear the last one or two or three shows, happy, happy new year. Happy 2022 with health and blessings and love and prosperity and positive thinking and doing random acts for humanity and making it a better world and doing what you want to do and be what you want to be. And let's get out of this new norm and get back to normal of living life and enjoying life and doing what we love to do. Enjoying family and enjoying friends and entertaining or cooking or whatever you like to do. It's time to give back to being normal. We've been hostages for going on 3 years now. And I don't know about you, but I think that we got it under control of what we should be doing and taking and breathing in fresh air and getting some sunshine and laughing. All of these things are very, very healthy. Well, today we have a dynamic guest for you, and her name is Judy Watson, and she wrote the book Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood. It's narrated by Richard Arlen to Maxine Kolish and edited by the dynamic researcher Judy Watson and author. And so in a minute, we're going to talk to Judy Watson about her wonderful book, Wings, and she's going to tell us some fantastic untold stories. So don't touch that dial. We'll be back in just a moment.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe.
I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up. It's the Rose, and we are going to enter into the world of authors and experts. And today we do have an author and an expert on her wonderful book called Wings. And it's, if you hadn't heard, it is about Richard Arlen. He actually had a groundbreaking silent movie called Wings, and the first film to win the Academy Award for Best Picture and the Virginian, the standard-setting Western that made Gary Cooper a star. And you can look that up on YouTube because they have the 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe even older than that, TV series and movies. And you'd be very surprised how exciting those actually and popular they actually happen to be. And check out some of these movie stars who have passed or are elderly now, perhaps, and they were absolutely fabulous. And this is Dick Arlen's story, as told to Maxine Coolidge, she says, and supported by photographs, books, letters, manuscripts, tapes, and diaries left to her daughter, Judy Watson. This fascinating memoir provides a behind-the-scenes look at Hollywood's golden age from a man who was center stage. So let's get started, and we'll ask Judy more about her book and about herself. Hi, Judy. How are you today?
Well, I'm fine, Rose. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
Well, I'm happy to be talking to you, too. It's a nice day where we're at. How about you?
Finally, the sun's come out. Yeah, and I'm so happy to see the sun, yes.
Me, too. So it's a great day, and it's a great day to talk about wings. You know, we think about angels' wings when we say wings, but this isn't about angels, your book, and it's about collections from early Hollywood, recollections from her early Hollywood. So why don't we start off with telling us why you decided to write this particular book, what motivated you, and tell us about the groundbreaking silent movie Wings.
I think, well, as you know, I found all these manuscripts, and I realized Mom had been recording Dick Arlen to prove to myself that it was real. I took out the tapes and I had them put on CDs, and indeed there was Richard telling his story. Nevertheless, it was now 2008 when she died. I didn't know if anybody remembered Wings. And so I put everything aside. I'm going to be very honest. My son is a writer, and he said, "Oh, Mom, people don't care." But on the night of 2012, the Academy Awards opened up with Wings. And I thought, oh my God, there it is. It has not been forgotten. And that really is what motivated me to do the book and make the picture the star of the book. Because that picture made him a star. He was nothing prior to the picture. And Paramount, you know, decided to reboot it. Why did they do that? It took me years to find out why. And the why.
Can you tell us why?
Yeah, finally. By accident, I got an email, and William Wellman Jr., the son of the director, was showing this film, Wings, at UCLA. And they were kind enough to give me his phone number. I called him, and he didn't know who I was, but he had worked with Richard, and then he was very cordial, and he sent me this book he had written for his father. Because really, this is a fascinating story. William Wellman was known as a really difficult man. He was the director on Wings. Wings is in the Library of Congress as the most important silent picture of its era. And when the first Academy Awards dinner was held, he was neither invited or allowed to come. Why? And that's the story I thought I would tell you. What do you think?
That's fantastic. Well, I think it's fantastic, and we want to hear it. But I wanted to also, what was the relationship between your mother and Richard Arlen?
Oh, that was a really, there's another interesting part. I had all these stories. Dick was a terrific storyteller, an Irish storyteller, and he was invited to funerals, and he did many conventions. And I looked all through those stories. Mother never put herself into the book. So I decided to write some information about her. Mom had a rough life, I think. She wanted to be an actress. She'd been very wealthy. She subsequently made bad marriages. And by the time she met Richard, she was really, it was a bad place. And they met each other at the old Weddington Golf Course, which is still there, though they've sold the course. And Richard immediately brought her over to Horace Height Estates, where he was living, and got her an apartment. And they were madly in love. That's the only thing I can tell you. And she just dedicated herself to him. It wasn't that I found just stories. I have many more stories that he dictated. I found every piece of information on him. I found love letters. I found cards. I found gifts he gave her, memorandums. It was everything to Mom. And after he died, she continued to write and rewrite the stories. And it made me sad, really, when I came upon the manuscripts to think how much of her life, almost 20 years, were devoted to him. And that was another reason why I thought, this is a book which is my tribute to two forgotten people, because he was forgotten, and so was she. And they made a little life together until he died. And so it was a very I made a very sweet book. I didn't put in gossip. I didn't put in anything of any bad story type of things. And there's always bad things you can do and say and tell. But no, I wanted people to remember him as the very nice, kind actor he was. And he was a wonderful friend to people. And I wanted them to have a good memory of her also. And
well, I think that's wonderful, except that you do mention that he was down on his luck and he was drinking heavily. And he was still married as well when he met your wife, right? Met your mother, right?
Those days, you couldn't have love affairs outside of marriage. There was no, type of divorce, right, unless you could prove things. And his third wife refused to divorce him. Further, he'd given her power of attorney in order to escape his second wife. He was dead broke, okay, and only acting in small movies and didn't have much, and he was drinking heavily. Later on, I read about William Holden, how he died. He would go, he would put himself into motels, and he would drink. And, he died accidentally. He fell and he hit his head, and he bled to death. Well, that was Richard's pattern, and I didn't know. My mother finally told me. What he would do was disappear for days at a time. Then he would call her, and she would go, and she would pay, and she didn't have much money, and she would bail him out, bring him back to her apartment, and sober him up. It was pretty sad. And I think they started the storytelling because she did it for him, because she wanted him to have some feeling that he was going to be remembered. And indeed,
well,
it was a very tragic kind of love story, but it was, she loved him and he loved her.
Well, apparently. So why don't you tell us, why was Wings an important story?
Well, Wings.
What was it about?
First of all,
the movie.
Go back and Richard had been around. Richard comes into the town really at the beginning of Motion Pictures. He works for Paramount, not even Paramount. And he's just a bit actor, and he's working in small productions. And then he got the opportunity to audition for Wings. Wings was actually created for Clara Bow, and because she was a big and a well-known star, and therefore they needed two young male actors to play pilots. And Dick said in the book, and he said he didn't realize what he was getting, this great opportunity. And it does, because this picture, which ran for 2 years, springboards him into films, and he has a career that lasts over 50 years. That's pretty remarkable, you know. But that's how
that
it got
is
started.
Remarkable. Yeah. Wow. So yeah. What was Wings about, though? Was it about the war? What was it about?
Wings actually is a very simple story. Okay, there's a couple of pieces of Wings. It is written by a fellow who comes to Paramount, and it's Lasky who puts it into motion. We didn't have a formal Air Force division. They were new. And Lasky gets the idea that they're going to go out to San Antonio. Let's see if this new Academy of Air Force people will allow us to do a movie there. Free. They actually used soldiers as extras, and everything else. This picture could never be done today, and it works. The Air Force wants everybody to know, oh, my gosh, the United States now has an Air Force. Please come and join, and they all work together. And the story, though, is really simple. I mean, in the story, Clara Bow was this pretty little girl, and she's in love with Buddy Rogers, but she doesn't know if he loves her. And she has a little bit of a flirtation with Richard, and the two fellows go off to war, and she follows them, and Richard gets shot down and killed, and she ends up, of course, with Buddy Rogers. That's the story. But the picture itself had never... What makes the picture unique? Forget the story. What made the picture unique was that I tried to explain in the book, all pictures were done in studio settings. That was for a valid reason. They could control light. They could control sound. They could control everything. When you go outside, you don't control anything. Everything changes. And this was so unique to do this picture outside in a setting. But that also made the problems, and that's why William Wellman gets himself in big trouble, because there was no such thing as special effects. So if the script called for a cloudy day, you had to wait for a cloudy day. if the script called for sunny days, you had to wait for a sunny day. And they get to San Antonio, and they don't have any idea what the weather's going to be like. And this causes massive delays in production, and the studio gets really angry with Wellman. They want to fire him. They want to get rid of him because it's going way over budget. And that's a fascinating story, and he's terrified that they're going to. And they send out a whole group of them to him to see him. And Wellman was a drinker, and that's the funniest story. He gets himself locked in his room. He won't answer the door to them. He gets dead drunk. And he has no idea what's going to happen. Finally, they slip a note under the door, and they leave. And the note says, you can continue the picture.
That is so funny. I've watched, I love old classic movies. I even got my kids and grandkids hooked on them. And you just reminded me that in a lot of those stories, they're always talking about when it's they're involved in making movies in the storyline, and they're always talking about we're going over budget, we got to stay under budget, you know. And that is so true, and you don't really think about it, but good grief, you know, it takes a lot of money to make a movie when you think about it. So it's very important not to go
over budget, because then you're going to run out of money, right, before the movie finishes.
Well, don't forget, the studio is run by people sitting in a back office. They're just looking at dollars and cents. They're not out there. They have no idea what you're dealing with. And I think for Wellman, this was a really big source of irritation. He had a terrible temper, and he was known. He was known as Wild Bill, and he would hit you as soon as, you know.
Oh.
If he didn't like it. Yeah. No, no. He's quite a character. And Richard, on the other hand, one of the things, I've read both the books, and one of the things my book shows me, and I knew Richard, he never had an enemy. Think about it. 50 years in the business, and kind, caring, and sweet. And that was his disposition. And every time he made a friend, if I read his stories throughout the book, that friend becomes a friend for life. And there's never any problems. Perhaps that's why his career went on as long as it did, you know. But Wellman, on the other hand, fights with everybody.
Richard Arlen was very handsome.
He was a very
handsome man.
But he's also very, very honest. He writes about the fact that when movies first began, especially silent movies, there were no plots, there were no stories, there was nothing. So you were picked solely for your looks, because you could just stand there, and then they could write a script after they took a picture of you lifting up a plate. Mary lifted up a broken plate because she was unhappy. Really? You know. But that's how they were done. And he was a beautiful young man. Gary Cooper was a beautiful young man. And Buddy was a gorgeous young man. And Clara Bow was adorable. So this is how actors were picked. Not for acting, but just how they looked. How they would fit into the movie, you know, that was being made.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they ended up at Horace Heights Estate. His dad was a big band leader involved in entertainment and traveling and entertaining around the country. And he was concerned about the actors and the actresses who were on budgets. And so he developed this Horace Heights Estate for them. And, many, many actors and actresses have lived there, and that's over in Sherman Oaks. And so your mother, you say, lived there for, what, 40 years?
Yeah, and here's the irony. My mother died, and Horace was very nice because he knew Richard, and he allowed us to use the lower room for her memorial, and he came up to me and he said, "How come your mother got to live here?" Anything. You know, he's a kid when my mom comes to live there. He has no idea how she got in there, because that was the rules of the game. You didn't live there unless you actively worked in the business. And that would change, of course. Poor Horace, he got sued for that. Discrimination. But at the time, he had no idea who my mother was. And I always think that's very funny, because I was married to a television cameraman who worked 50 years in the business, and both my kids work in the business. And but he didn't know me. He didn't know Mother. I'm like, how did you get in here?
I know. I got introduced by a mutual friend of ours, Pat Walmsley, who worked for a congressman at the time. And she lived there, and that's how I ended up meeting Horace Heights. So it's really a small world, and enjoyed his luau's every year since. And so tell us, you know, because of what's happening today, and with these lockdowns and targeting people in our country and in Europe and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. You mention in your book that Jews in the part of the world lived in constant fear of being exiled or murdered outright for their religious beliefs. So America was the opportunity to live in a free, safe society. And the young couple might immigrated with their family to America in the late 1800s. And from a part of Latvia. And I found that interesting because today almost everyone is living in fear, and especially the Jews, because they're being attacked over in that area again or threatened. And so how does that make you feel when you wrote that and what's happening today?
Well, I think at the time I wrote it, we weren't living like we are today. I wrote the book back in around 2013, 2014. It took me about a year. I guess I published it in 2015. I had read many books on Jewish people because I'm Jewish and I was not religious, but still you are always knowing that you are part of a group that suffered. What, 6 million people were killed simply because of a religion. And I've studied and read many, many books regarding this. And the fear of just having someone know that you might be of a different religion, that was enough to get you killed if you went outside your ghetto, you know, or a place that you were allowed to live in, nor were you allowed to hold particular jobs. And but in 1880, because I think I went on a Jewish website, Jewish history website, in 1880, the doors opened in this country. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants came out of Europe, not just Jewish people, but from Eastern Europe, Polish, from everywhere. Anyone who could get into this country, the Irish came because of the Irish famine, you know, everybody.
The Italians, everybody. Yeah, that could.
Right. And so to say that they came here just as being Jews was part of it, but I think it was just the wonderful ability to go to a new country. People were needed. People were wanted if you were healthy. But you couldn't come in poor. I think that was the part that was interesting to me, that my cousin would tell me that my great-grandmother's husband's mother came first with her other son. He had to save up money, and then he was able to bring his family here. You had to be healthy. You had to be able to support yourself and your family. You had to have some money, and you also had to come in and register either Ellis Island or these other places. And this pertained to everybody that came into this country. And this is why it's difficult to see what's happening here today. How does that work?
Because the truth is, like my grandparents, they said when they got here at Ellis Island that they were kissed the ground because they were so happy to be where there was a land of opportunity. They weren't coming for a handout. They were coming to work and build a family and have a family. They were young and have a family and buy the American dream, which was the home back then, and have a job. So my grandfather ended up working in the coal mines. And so actually there is a book, a rare book somebody wrote, and they wrote the names of the coal miners who had to stay in these camps, Judy, and stay away from their family because it was too far for them to travel back and forth. So they had to stay there and work, and then they'd go back home, I don't know for how long, and then they'd come back and to the camps. And my grandfather, Philip S. Colombo, his name is in that book. And I was like so excited to find that book. And because this is many years ago. And so I think all these tidbits are so interesting, like when you put this in your book, because today, as you know and I know, it's very frightening when they started arresting Christians in America for going to church on Sunday. And for praying in California, they said Governor Newsom said you couldn't chant, you couldn't pray, you couldn't sing. It was unbelievable. And they were giving $500 tickets to anyone parked in the parking lots. And they may have done it at the Jewish temples too. I don't know, but it was definitely they were on target for the Christians and conservatives and who are a majority of Christians are Catholics and Bible thumpers and so forth, they call them. And so I find it really interesting that you wrote that particular part, because paragraph, because I think we always have to be on our guard, no matter if we're Christians, Jews, Catholics. We have to remember we're all Americans, right?
Well, Richard, he writes, but I could pass that by too. His father, they were Irish. And when he was a little boy, I mean, they just would make things out of reeds. They were poor. His father was poor, and his father became a Supreme Court judge there in where they lived. And think of the ability to rise from poor beginnings, educate yourself, and rise to being a judge. And this is Richard's background. And he writes a lot about his family and his beginnings. And I put that in the book because it was so fascinating to me, because I knew nothing of that era. I knew about my relatives. I can tell you that my great-grandfather became a peddler, which was not uncommon. He went door to door carrying a huge sack on his back, probably 50 pounds. And when they had enough money, they opened a small general store in a place called Hawthorne, Illinois. And they would say to people, if you need a meal, go to the Jew's house. And I think, what do they mean? Because it was a railroad town. What do you mean you go to the Jew's house? Because the Jewish religion always tells you to put that plate there for the stranger.
Mm-hmm.
They want to show, they always give back. And so if you were traveling through and you had no place to meet, stay or no place to eat, you would be told, go to the Jew's house. And they were the only Jewish family in the entire town. I mean, that was difficult. My grandmother talks a lot about it. She tells a lot of stories. And she and her sisters all grew up. But they ended up, and I've got pictures my aunt had of a wonderful general store that they built there, but they never wanted to stay there. They all migrated to Chicago. They all married, middle-class, wealthier Jewish men who had done better in their lives, and everything began to evolve. And so it's a really fascinating story just to watch how people immigrate, how they begin to adapt, and how they change with the ability
right.
to know that they can progress, you know?
Exactly, but I also noted that the immigrants, like my grandparents, they moved into an Italian neighborhood. Everybody was Italian. And so the Jews, they had their community, and the Irish had their community, and da-da-da-da-da. And I think... you know, and everybody was discriminated against, you know, for one reason or another. They didn't like their food, or they didn't like the way they talked, or their, you know, the way their behaviors were, like, you know, loud or using your hands and all that. But eventually to become a melting pot and accept each other. And I think, you know, that this is the only country in the world that has that history. And, you know, for people to say we're racist, that is an individual choice. It is not the majority of Americans. And I don't think they should throw us into a big pot like that. And so in your book, though, Wings, you also say that he was successful, right, as a movie star. And then he came upon hard times, right? When he started to age?
Yes. I would say it was more age and younger actors coming on the scene. And he just wasn't wanted. So he did what a lot of actors do. And I found this out when I went. You know, I volunteered for several years at the Motion Picture Home. And one of the things I volunteered to do was to write up stories. They would interview people coming into the home. They would put it on a videotape, and then it would just rot. So I said, well, let me type them up, you know. And they were wonderful stories. But if you go back to early years, and many of these people came in, in the silent era, coming forward, and they were very similar stories to where they adjusted. They became part of the culture. They begin to rise. But then many of the men, just like Dick, found themselves giving lectures. Dick was a golfer, so he was, you know, he would go out and he would give lectures and tell stories and he would tell jokes. And he became known as a wonderful Irish storyteller, and he was. I had so much fun and pleasure. Even now when I go through the manuscripts, when I read the different stories that he would write about people, one of the most fascinating things, and I'm so happy you're asking me to tell you about Richard, was he never wrote about himself. His stories are about other actors, what happened to them, what happened in that play, what happened, you know, in their story of their life. And when I've read books by most actors, it's all about them, but not him. And that's why I always liked him and really wanted to do something where I could share those terrific stories. I was going to write another book, but then Create Space, I told you, they went belly up, Bezos closed it, and I don't know exactly where I would go because they were wonderful. Create Space was a marvelous self-publishing company, and they did a terrific job for me, and I was happy to pay them and to see what evolved. And the book did pretty well. I was surprised. I never had any expectation,
well,
you know.
Yeah, they have some small book publishing companies that don't charge an arm and a leg, and they do a really good job. And so you'll find someone that will, you know, if you want to write another book, which I think you will. I just have a feeling.
Interesting stories that he told, and they would be of different producers and directors and stars and people, you know, and people that you would see on a screen and you would think, oh, what a marvelous person, who in person was just a nervous wreck, you know, fell apart. And,
That's the illusion of seeing celebrities on the screen, and then sometimes, you know, I think sometimes they shouldn't publish, you know, things that destroy the illusion of the public. Do you know what I'm saying? Like you have these movie stars on a pedestal and they did great acting and they entertained you and you enjoyed their movies. And then here comes the rag newspaper or whatever, and they just have to tear them down. And I see in your book you didn't, just because he had a drinking problem, you were kind and you did not tear him down. You lifted him up, in fact.
Yeah, I just, when I inquired and read about William Holden, I loved William Holden. In fact, my son's middle name is Holden. We named him Mitchell Holden. And to find out how tragically his life would end and how sad that was, because I still, when he comes on the screen, when old William Holden movie, I know I'm going to watch it. He was a wonderful actor. And so many of them gave us so much. And I just don't like to see people torn down. Because you know what it is? Very briefly, audience, my husband worked in television for many, many years. They make their money by selling time. Nobody wants to buy, this is the merchants that they sell to, time that's boring. So they want exciting time. Who just shot who? Who just got killed? Who is a bad person? Who did we just discover? And this is, by the way, what makes television go. So when I watch TV, for me, so much of it is just propaganda, because I understand that it's like merchandise that's being peddled to the public in a very oftentimes horrible way, because they want you to stay on their station, watch their station, and they can sell that time. And it's so I had that choice in the book. I could write about Dick. I knew he was drunk. I knew he had all kinds of problems. I knew he would have lost his money. I knew everything. I didn't want to do that. Why?
Well, I think,
why?
Yeah, what for is the whole reason, you know, what does it, I mean, it's better to, especially when people pass, I think it's better to leave those points out. No one needs to know or talk about it. They need to have good memories of everybody's life and who left, you know, their mark behind in a good way. for everybody else. And everyone has problems. I mean, they could tear all of us apart, right? Split second, boom.
Junior about his dad, he uses his dad's diaries and he really exposes his father's drinking, he exposes his father's temper, and he exposes all the difficult parts of Wellman that made his career so, what's the word, peripatetic, you know, up and down. But he was also, like I have found when I watch old movies, a genius, an absolute genius. So we get to see the pieces of his father, and but do we really need to see all of that? I don't know. Because what he wants for his dad, and the reason he wrote the book, I'm absolutely convinced, he wrote the book to finally get recognition for his dad and hopefully some kind of award or posthumous Oscar. And he fails. Nothing happens. He gets a manager. He goes around the country for a year. He appears on television. He sells the book. And nothing. Nothing. And that signaled to me that when something is over, it's over, you know. So let's remember that person in a better way.
And
I would have loved the book. I knew he loved his dad, but it would, you know, it would have been nice to see his father as a more of a heroic man fighting against what he considered to be, you know, the practices of, but it's always that way in big business. You produce or you get out. That's business. And but he wanted just to show his father, hoping final recognition, and he didn't. That's the sad part of the book, to me. Hoping.
Well,
you know.
Well, you also say in your book that timing is most important for the actor.
It's everything. You have to get on, and you have to get off. You know, you have to know when.
And
to get
do you think it's very difficult for actors and actresses to, and maybe that's why they sometimes turn to alcoholism or drugs or whatever, because that experience of having so much fame, then all of a sudden you don't hear from anybody. I mean, that's like a high and a low.
Well, you know, my son wanted to be an actor, and through Mitchell I got to know all his friends and see all his acting years. And I have great admiration for actors because nobody understands what it is that drives them inside of themselves to want to act and to want to be seen. It isn't just recognition. It's a need to be another person, to find another life. You know, I mean, I've seen so many fine actors, a great many of them, my dear, end up at the motion picture home dead broke, okay? And that was why the motion picture home was created. And so I don't know, does the audience get tired of them? I read somewhere that most actors are lucky if they have 20 years and most have 10. And I found that often to be true. And some of the nicest actors and good people, when I would write up their stories, I think, oh, is this what happened to you? You know. And so I do think the motion picture home serves a really good cause. You know, we take care of our own. And it's that's what their basis is. And in the old days, you know, they were supported by huge unions, but as the big studios were broken up and they disappeared, the making of actors disappeared, you know. And so, but still, I admire anybody who gets up on a stage. I really do, you know.
Well, it's true, though. I mean, everybody ages, and then you've got to find a different part to play in a film or a TV series or whatever. And some of them still do today. You know, they were famous back in the day, and they're still somewhat famous, but they're, you know, they continue on with making TV movies, which in the past, when I read that most movie stars shunned television and thought that would ruin their careers. So there's a lot of things that happen between then and now, right?
Well, when I came into television, I'll tell you a little story. I always thought it was so interesting. I used to call Dick, my Dick, the last of the Mohicans, because it was studio, which was Channel 5, was owned by Paramount. And they were so convinced, the cameramen at Paramount Studios, that television would disappear after a few years, that they took 10 fellows into the cinematography union, and Dick was the last. And, of course, we know what happened in television. It made film disappear. But they didn't know that. They didn't expect that. It was just, they thought they were doing Dick a favor. And this is what happens. And then when my kids began, they began in animation. I remember my daughter worked with a gal, taught her. Oh, she said to her, animation will be here for 5 years. That was 25 years ago, you know. And then we developed all ways of doing animation. And today, it's a huge, huge field. So everything evolves, and everything changes. And, it's so interesting to me to watch all
nothing
that
stays,
happen.
Nothing stays the same, and everything changes, and technology changes. And if you don't stay up with it, then you just get left behind.
Yeah, it's kind of scary, especially for us getting older, you know, because it's not just knowing how to work a computer. You have to know how to work a phone. You have to know how to work an iPad. You have to know how to...
I don't know. They're making things today where you don't have to do anything. You don't have to think. You don't have to do anything. I mean, kids pick up a phone now and they never look up anymore because they're so busy watching movies or playing games, or they can find the answers to their homework online. I mean, they really don't have to do a lot of thinking or use their imagination too much today.
That makes me sad because we came from the
generation. Yeah, it is sad.
Yeah, we came out of the radio era. I did. But here's an interesting story. So Sirius, and I shouldn't give them a plug because I don't even buy them, but my daughter takes it. And you know what she listens to? She listens to Fibber McGee and Molly. She listens to old-time radio, theater, and shows and programs. And I thought, isn't that wonderful that there are people who listen, you know?
Oh, they're so popular because people are tired of all the violence and glorifying drugs and violent sex and, I mean, raw sex, which is pornography on family TV you're watching, and all the cursing. And it's almost like they run out of words sometimes, or they're using the F words so much that, you know, there's no storyline. It's like, couldn't they think of anything that people actually communicate with?
But we had, in the movies, and I can't remember what they were called, they had very strict rules. Remember about sex and words and things like that? When television first began, it was actually under the same kind of dominion. And I remember that if you were, like, working, as we did in television, you had to do so much public work every year. You had to donate to public things. If you didn't, you could lose your license. There were things you could show and things you couldn't show. There were things you could say and things you couldn't say. And I don't know when. I don't know when that disappeared. But I think it's gone. All those standards that we had are gone. And
there's
once
no standards anymore, are there?
No, not that I know of. And then it becomes a free-for-all.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, it's a free-for-all, and it's really sad because you'll be watching a really good movie, and all of a sudden, here's this scene that doesn't even fit in it or is not necessary, where they're doing sexual things that should not be in the movie in your home, unless you're into pornography, and it's really, like, I just turn it off at that point. I'm just like, this is ridiculous, you know, and, I mean, we all know how to do it and what's done and everything else. We don't need to have raw sex that was pornography in the past and now is in your living room and in a movie that's really good, and then, boom, there it is.
I think the greatest love scene of all is in From Here to Eternity. Remember that love scene on the beach with Burt Lancaster and Deborah Carr. And what happens? They lie down in the sand, they kiss each other passionately, a wave washes over them, and fade to black. And you have your imagination telling you that you have witnessed this beautiful love scene. That's all you need to have.
That's all anybody needs to have. And actually, it's more interesting to people because they do use their imagination, you know what I mean? And or they used to, like, have a sexy scene where, you know, she's standing at the bedroom door and some, you know, sexy negligee, and then they, you know, and then they, maybe she'd go in the room and he'd start to follow her in, and then they'd cut the scene. We know what they were going to do. Hello.
No, I just watched a remake. It was an old movie, Pretty Woman, with Richard Gere and well-known actress.
That was like in the 90s, wasn't it?
Well, I think so, 80s. She plays a prostitute, so, but there's no sexual scenes in that movie. And there's you know what's going to happen. But so what? Fade to black. You don't
need
to be.
That's why it was so popular, though. Those movies are more popular.
I want to say something else here. I want to address the homosexual part of filmmaking. There's been homosexual people in the film industry for as long as I can remember. This is the funniest thing I ever saw. I saw a documentary one night on Turner Classics. These two fellows did it. And there's a scene in the movie of Wings in which Richard is shot down, Buddy embraces him, and they kiss. And they said, this is the first homosexual embrace. And I started laughing my head off because this was just, you know, Italian men, they kissed each other in Europe. It wasn't uncommon. And Wellman has them show some affection. And I thought, you're talking about Richard Arlen, who was married 3 times and slept with every single actress he could in Hollywood? And you're going to tell me that this guy is in a sexual embrace with Buddy? I don't think so. But
no, in Europe, a lot of the countries, the men kiss on the cheeks, and sometimes they just quickly kiss on the lips. You know, like a father and son, and they hug, but they aren't homosexuals. I'm not knocking homosexuals or anything. I'm just saying that was just a part of their culture.
I'll tell you a funny story. Mitchell wanted to be an actor. He got an agent. He gets a call to go out on a commercial. So he's 15. So I took him. Okay. So we're standing there. We're waiting in this big, huge room, and I said, who are we waiting for? Oh, he said, we're waiting for the audio man. I said, oh, okay. Finally, in comes a fellow, and he's got hair down to his shoulders. He's got full makeup on. He's got a parrot on his shoulders. He's wearing a tight T-shirt, jeans, and boots. And I start to laugh, and the guy says to me, no, he'll leave. You know, that's our audio man, you know. And I realized, oh, okay. And I go home and I tell Dick what I've seen, and he says to me, Judy, this is show business. And it was, and it is.
And it is. But if you look at the old classic movies, there were a lot of movies where the guys dressed up as girls as funny scenes and stuff in the movies, you know, and they wore makeup and stuff.
I watched Someone Get Hot the other night. That's one of the funniest movies ever made. You know, in which Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon dress up as women. Remember? With Marilyn Monroe. Oh, my gosh. It's hilarious. It's a wonderful movie. I don't think, and if anybody in the woke generation listens to your blog, I it's not necessary. Really and truly, we don't have to have it spelled out. That person is black. That person is Mexican. That person is Puerto Rican.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm so sick of it. No, I really am. I mean, I think most Americans are. We can look at somebody and know they're black. We don't need to be pointed out that they're black. And they don't. Nobody needs to point it out to us. We know it. I mean, and you don't know if someone who's olive-skinned is Sicilian, Italian, Greek, or from Spain, which is European, or from Mexico or Brazil. You really don't know. They just assume, and that's an insult to all these different cultures. They are proud of their own.
All right. And we would go to Mexico. And every time I was in Mexico with Dick many years ago, I would be asked if I was a Mexican. And I thought, what are you talking about? I'm blonde. I'm blue-eyed. And finally, I realized that what happened, and people, please be aware, after the war, many European people could not get into the United States. So they settled in Mexico. They settled in Hawaii. They settled wherever South America was very big, wherever they were allowed to go. And therefore, they intermingled, they intermarried, and different colors got involved, you know. And therefore, me with my blonde hair and my blue eyes and my porcelain skin, I was being asked wherever I went if I was a Mexican. I always thought that was fascinating.
My niece is blonde and green eyes, and she said somebody asked her that too. That's so strange, you know. And I mean, not that it matters. I mean, she just thought it was strange because she has green eyes and blonde hair, and my granddaughters all have blonde hair. My grandmother was blonde with blue eyes, and I'm like my grandfather, Sicilian. I'm dark, you know. So.
Throwback. One of the things I wish everybody would take this. I took a class called I think it was physical anthropology, it was physical and cultural, in which we studied what happens to people as they come together, live together, move around the planet, and it's called, I think, habituation. You change, you know.
There's almost no peer anything because countries have been conquered since the beginning of time. They raped the women. They raped the children. They, you know, they brought them in as slaves for the kings to do whatever. And I mean, it's like there's no peer anything, to tell you the truth.
Right.
That if they were to do their genealogy and their DNA and all that, they'd find that they have a mixture. They wouldn't be peer anything because there's no such thing anymore. All nations were conquered, and all nations, they did that back in the day, you know. And they're still raping women today, sadly.
You go and you really look and begin to study, which I did because I was so curious, because why is it that people thought Jewish people looked like Fagin, you know, in Oliver Twist? And I remember I had an Italian girlfriend get mad at me because she'd say, they think you look more Jewish than I do, or I look more Jewish than you. That's what she would say. Because she had dark hair and dark skin. And I thought, that's because people want to buy into stereotypes. I think they feel
safe. I've been asked if I was Greek, if I was Spanish, if I was Italian, if I was Jewish, I mean, you name it, I have been asked it. And, you know, so, I mean, people don't know, they're guessing. But Judy Watson, we're out of time, unfortunately. The editor of Wings and Other Recollections of Early Hollywood, what a fantastic narration. By Richard Allen to Maxine Coolish, your mother. What a great gift you left for your mother and Richard Arlen behind, and for Hollywood. And
I hope
maybe it'll turn into a movie one day.
Well, it isn't a movie. I made the book very inexpensive, and it's practically free but the point was, most of the books I have seen on Hollywood, very convoluted, very expensive, and I thought, no. He made a simplified story of early Hollywood, how it began, what it looked like, where you went, what you did, and I thought, people need to be educated and to know, and it doesn't have to be expensive, all right, or convoluted.
Right.
And that's why the book is very inexpensive, and I always hoped people would see it, and they have. Many people have seen it more as a history of Hollywood itself and how it evolved.
And where can they get your book, Wings?
I'm still on Amazon. Yeah, Amazon,
okay.
Barnes & just put in the title and it'll come up with tons of places to buy it. And it's $12 and it's just not expensive. I mean, because, well, that was done purposely because I want it to be something that all...
You want it to be affordable so more people can read it.
Correct. And I think that did help me a great deal. And what's the word when you get it free, when you buy it and you put it on your computer, you know, that, I think it's free there. With Amazon, you make a deal with Amazon, you get everything free, you know. But, right, I think. But anyway, the point is, it's a simple, Hollywood evolves, Hollywood begins. Hollywood, to me, is still a fabulous story. And here it is, right at the beginning. And he came in right at the beginning. And therefore, you know, he has that knowledge of just what it was to be behind the scenes, in front of the camera. And I enjoy the book every time I pick it up. And these aren't my stories, folks, but I took his stories and I tried to make them as enjoyable as possible for people.
Well, thank you so much, and, you know, we want to also thank our wonderful friend Horace Hyde and Pat Walmsley, because if anybody's out there, we ask for prayers for Pat and healing and love, and we want to say hi to her and send her blessings. And to Judy and her great book, we thank you so much, Judy, and thank you for coming on Columbo Chronicles today and sharing these wonderful stories with us about Hollywood and your experiences and Richard Arlen with your great book, Wings, and God bless you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, sweetheart. Talk to you later. All right. Bye.
All right. Bye. And that's all we have time for. Remember, nothing said on Columbo Chronicles is intended to be legal, medical, financial, political advice, just a dissemination of information for educational and entertainment purposes only. And I hope you were educated and entertained today. So we'll talk to you again. Have a great day, and God bless you. This is The Rose signing off. Judy Watson has left the building, author and editor of Wings, and Rose Colombo must leave the building too.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Columbo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or, if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Columbo Chronicles.